It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
If he had won an Emmy, I bet he wouldn't have run for president. The president has complained repeatedly that the Emmys are rigged because, unlike the presidency, Emmys go to the winner of the popular vote.
Well, back in 1980, in that movie, we refused to be controlled by a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot.
And in 2017, we still refuse to be controlled by a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot.
My wife and I had 3 children in 3 years, and we didn't have a child last year during the SNL season. I wonder if there's a correlation there. All you men up there, you put that orange wig on, it's birth control, trust me.
We did have a whole storyline about an impeachment, but we abandoned that because we were worried that someone else might get to it first.
I want to thank Trump for making black people number one on the most oppressed list. He's the reason I'm probably up here.
On a very personal note, I want to say thank you to Hillary Clinton for your grace and grit. And thank you, my mother and sister. I'm so proud of you, Mom.
All right, that's the Emmys last night. Anybody watch it? Not me. I tell you, I am sick of Hollywood celebrities. I don't want to hear what they have to say. I don't care what they say. I really, in fact, it has so translated to even watching movies. And I have for years been a movie buff. I really enjoy movies. You know, I try to carefully select them for sure, but there are some, most actors and actresses now, I just can't even bear to watch them. And even their old movies, you know, it's over, folks, it's over. And that's maybe why the box office this summer, the movie box office has just plummeted. And so they're, you know, trying to figure out what to do. They can't quite figure out that maybe they should just do their craft. You know, I used to be a professional musician. And all of my friends were actresses and musicians and wonderfully gifted. But that does not translate to understanding political knowledge. Now, there are some exceptions. Sometimes people are left and right brain, but for the most part, not. Anyway, so that's what happened last night. You might have seen all those ribbons that they wore. Those were ribbons in support of the oppressed, you know, American Civil Liberties Union, which has been really the... Before we had all of these other better-known organizations, the ACLU was the early enemy, really, I think, of this country and its freedoms. I don't think there's too much of an argument on that. I'm sure there are by ACLU supporters. But they wore the ribbons last night. They have been weighing in against Trump's policies, against transgenders. Most recently, these are their activities. And then, of course, all about the immigration. They've been stopping the immigration enforcement in courts, filing briefs around the country. And the way the ACLU, of course, makes their money is that they sue people. They have huge amounts of attorneys, lots of money, and they sue people out of existence. You know, just average folk or just regular people standing up. I don't have the funds, don't have the ability, the resources to fight back when they're sued by the ACLU. So that's how they've made all their money through the years. So the Hollywood, now they're the champions of the ACLU, the oppressed ACLU, wearing ribbons in solidarity. And could I just say, you know, maybe it's just time for us to close the door on Hollywood as we've known it. Not movies and entertainment. I just think we've got to develop some sort of a counterculture on that. And I think efforts are underway to do that, actually. All right, so that was the Emmys last night. But, of course, real life things were actually happening over the weekend. St. Louis was the center, again, of civil unrest, whether it's Black Lives Matter, Antifa. It's just amazing to me what they are allowed to get away with. Griff Jenkins was on the street this morning talking about what the third night in St. Louis was like. Let's listen.
A third night of violent protesters. The pattern is the same. It starts out peaceful with marches during the day, and by nightfall, what police here are calling criminals taking to the streets and just destroying small businesses just like this. You see a guy kicking in this nail's center last night. Over 80 arrests last night. The total of 3 days, over 120. And it's caused a dozen or more officers who have been attacked by these evening protesters, these agitators, to be injured. Fortunately, none life-threatening, but certainly the sort of thing you don't want to see. The city obviously reeling after 3 years after Ferguson and what we saw play out there tonight, or last night rather, overnight. The 80 arrests, the largest of the protests that we've seen so far. The local leaders, Mayor Lyda Crewson and Chief Lawrence O'Toole, saying that this will not be tolerated. Nonetheless, we talked to some of the protesters, including one of their own, a state representative, Bruce Franks Jr. Here's what he had to say about the violence that's happening in the streets. Take a listen.
Systematic racism, systematic injustice, and it has to change.
You got hurt folks that feels like a system has failed them. So I understand folks being upset about broken windows, but we got broken lives out here. That doesn't compare.
Now, over the weekend, we did talk with Governor Eric Greitens as well, who tried to get in front of this, mobilizing the National Guard here in Missouri, as well as giving the police every confidence that he could has their back and that this sort of violence won't be tolerated. We're told later this morning there may be another march gathering as people try and come to work on Monday, but we'll see. The hope here with all leaders is that this does not continue to escalate.
I just think it's amazing what they're allowing to do to policemen. I saw some of the video, I'm sure you did too, attacking them, jumping up on their cars. Really? Allowing them to do this? I just don't understand that. Grievances, legitimate grievances on racism or any kinds of injustice by political authorities cannot be allowed to be expressed like that. There must be law and order. Police have to have the ability to rein in the populace. They just have to be able to do that. When the respect becomes so, the disrespect becomes so epidemic, it has to be stopped. And the only good news I can think about this is in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, there were supposed to be these major rallies. One of them was what I mentioned to you a few weeks ago, the mother of all rallies. That's what they were calling it. And it was supposed to be for Trump supporters, for people who wanted to make America great again. They didn't use that slogan, but that's what they said. And as some of us began to notice on their website and the way they were advertising, we didn't recognize any of the names, none of the speakers, none of the organizers. And yet it was being billed as this big, you know, pro-Trump, pro-America rally. And then we began to suspect, you know, this, methinks this is a setup. Because meanwhile, this other rally was beginning in Charlottesville. Remember, they were going to march to Washington and converge there this weekend? And recall that that march that we started out telling you about sort of went nowhere. We don't even know where it went. It just became silent, this so-called march from Charlottesville to Washington, D.C. That's what the week that the hurricane hit in Houston and then in Florida. So what happened this weekend with this mother of all rallies and the convergence of the other rally was almost like it's a big fizzle. I watched an NBC News report out of D.C., and it just looked like nothing came to nothing. So it seems to me all of the Antifa protesters and the Black Lives Matter, the corrupt portion of those, I'm sure there are some people marching with them. I don't know how this could be, how you could be this dumb, but I'm sure there are people marching alongside those groups who actually believe what they say they believe. But they're being used by leftists who have another agenda, and that is total chaos. So I think that the worst types converged on St. Louis. So it's like the hurricane. St. Louis got it as opposed to D.C., but don't think they're going to quit. And, of course, with Hollywood help doing their part, fanning the flames, it's pretty amazing to watch. And it does give you the impression that it's overwhelming and that there's almost no use to resist, but I don't believe that's true. I still think this is if they couldn't pull out a major protest in D.C. at the same time they're, caught wreaking havoc in St. Louis, and they're not very big. So take heart at that. And some of you may have watched Tucker Carlson last Thursday night because he had Mike Isaacson on. And Mike is a John Jay College professor. That's in New York. And he was on with Tucker. He's a leader of Antifa. So this is what he tweeted. People went back in his tweets. And one of the things Michael Isaacson, adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, tweeted was, some of y'all might think it sucks being an anti-fascist teacher at John Jay College, but I think it's a privilege to teach future dead cops. That's what he had to say on his Twitter account. So the New York Daily News reached out to Isaacson on Friday after he appeared with Tucker, and there was massive response about his anarchy, the fact that he's a professor teaching policemen, future policemen. But this is what he said. This is his response, because he's real concerned, you know. He's real concerned. He said, oh, that blank? Everybody dies. That was his response. When they asked him about his comment that it was a privilege to teach future dead cops, the New York Daily News challenges Isaacson, the professor from John Jay College, and he says, oh, that blank? Everybody dies. So that's his concerned response to the New York Daily News inquiries. And not to, this whole business of mad professors is kind of epidemic. By the way, the Isaacson is, as I recall, he's white, long-haired. This is a black professor from Emory who's now declared that all white people are racists. He's George Yancey, professor of philosophy at Emory University. He's written some books, and now he's saying that all white people are racists. Okay, so not like I haven't heard that before or that it's a shock. It's just these are the people teaching our kids. These are the people teaching our kids. And could I please remind everyone listening that the civil rights movement, led by Dr. Martin Luther King, had no such theme. Dr. Martin Luther King said, rightly, because he understood God's view of this, that men should be judged on the basis of their character and not their color. But somehow that memo was lost, and so the people now carrying the water for the so-called civil rights movement are blinded. There are white racists, and there are black racists. By the way, there are brown racists. There are people that hate people and hate people that are not anything like them. And they exist in every color and creed. They have since the beginning of the foundations of this world. But please let Dr. Martin Luther King remind us of God's view that men are judged. Man looks on the outside appearance, but God looks on the heart. But these are the people that are teaching our kids. And, of course, then there's Harvard. Embracing Chelsea Manning, the traitor, to come and be one of their adjunct professors. Let's listen to this report from Molly Lyon.
In the wake of growing backlash, the Harvard Kennedy School has rescinded Chelsea Manning's invite to serve as a visiting fellow, though an invitation for the convicted spy to speak stands. This coming after CIA Director Mike Pompeo canceled his participation in the school's forum, withdrawing in a last-second letter, calling Manning an American traitor. Adding, Ms. Manning stands against everything the brave men and women I serve alongside stand for. The transgender woman who served as an intel analyst in the U.S. Army was convicted in 2013 of espionage and other crimes for leaking classified documents to WikiLeaks. She was released from prison in May, serving 7 years of a 35-year sentence after former President Barack Obama granted a commutation. Douglas Elmendorf, dean of the Harvard Kennedy School, released a statement today, writing, "We did not intend to honor her in any way or to endorse any of her words or deeds, as we do not honor or endorse any fellow. However, I now think that designating Chelsea Manning as a visiting fellow was a mistake for which I accept responsibility. However, Manning is still invited to spend a day at the Kennedy School and speak in the forum." President Donald Trump's former White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, recently announced as a visiting fellow in the same release, said he appreciated that Harvard rectified its mistake.
There is a need in this country to have a civil discourse and have the free expression of ideas. That's what makes our country so amazing. But it is quite another to take someone who has been a traitor to this country, who's been convicted of treason, and invite them.
Manning herself weighed in, tweeting, "Honored to be first disinvited trans woman visiting Harvard fellow. They chill marginalized voices under CIA pressure. Hashtag, we got this. Pompeo made it clear in his letter that his decision had nothing to do with Manning's identity as a transgender person, but everything to do with her identity as a traitor.
Just to remind you, Bradley Manning, in a snit over a gay lover quarrel, released thousands and thousands and thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks, which put people in danger and some have said have caused the deaths of others. But Barack Obama released Bradley from prison. And while Bradley was in prison, Bradley had a sex change operation paid for, courtesy of your tax dollars. And now Harvard wants Bradley, Chelsea, to be a lecturer. It is really unbelievable. And by the way, there's more to say about transgender troops. It looks like the Pentagon is now going to allow treatments to continue, transgender soldiers to reapply for entry. I'm thinking things are not going quite the way we had in mind. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
In America today, religious freedom, national borders, and even traditional gender roles are in peril. With all that's happening in our world, our nation is in desperate need of a return to conservative values. Hello, I'm Buddy Smith, Senior Vice President of American Family Association. One of the best ways we can make a difference is with our vote. That's why each year the American Family Association is a sponsor of the Values Voters Summit to help increase cultural engagement. This year's Values Voters Summit will be October 13th through the 15th in Washington, D.C. The growing list of confirmed speakers includes people you hear on AFR like Ed Battagliano and Tawny Perkins, as well as Michelle Bachman, George Barna, Gary Bauer, the Benham Brothers, and more. The Values Voters Summit is sponsored in part by AFA Action. To learn more and to register, you can visit valuesvotersummit.org.
Hey, I'm Phil Wickham. Each of us might have a friend, neighbor, or loved one who struggles with substance abuse, but there is a way out.
Hi, I'm Angela. I went to a friend's house knowing that he did methamphetamines, and I told him I need some, and I stayed up for about 5 days. I was just going nowhere. When I came into Teen Challenge, I was trying to figure out who God was. It's just nice to be able to lean against Him and say, it's not my strength, it's yours. It's good to know that I don't have to go through this life anymore by myself.
If you or a loved one, whether a teen or adult, is ready to end an addiction, Teen Challenge can help. You can call them toll-free at 1-855-END-ADDICTION or visit them online at teenchallengeusa.com. You're listening to American Family Radio.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Paul Kizito. I'm a junior biology major here at Truett McConnell, and I came from Uganda. What I love about TMU is number one is the heart of, you know, of just the school and the love for God, for Christ. You can see it once you step on the campus. Like, you can see it's best, like, the foundation for TMU is Christianity.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
Harvard University had to be publicly shamed, but they finally did the right thing, revoking Chelsea Manning's invitation to be a visiting fellow. Manning was sentenced to 35 years in prison for stealing 700,000 military and State Department documents and giving those documents to WikiLeaks. President Obama later commuted Manning's sentence. Harvard faced national backlash over the invitation. CIA Director Mike Pompeo canceled an upcoming appearance at the school, calling Manning an American traitor. And former CIA Deputy Director Mike Morrell resigned in protest from his post at the university, saying he did not want to be part of any organization that honors a convicted felon and leaker. The fact is, Manning, who now identifies as a woman, put American lives in danger, and the fellowship invitation was a disgrace. Chelsea Manning should be sitting in a prison cell at Fort Leavenworth, not a classroom at Harvard. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The Trump administration is staying in the Iran nuclear deal, though warned it could withdraw, and announced a new round of punishment for Iran's activities outside the 2015 nuclear agreement. In London, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says Iran is clearly in default of the expectations of the deal.
President Trump has made it clear to those of us who are helping him develop this policy that we must take into account the totality of Iranian threats. Not just Iran's nuclear capabilities. That is one piece of our posture towards Iran.
Meeting today's deadline, the Trump administration will continue suspending certain sanctions against Iran. That keeps the U.S. in the Iran deal. Though the Treasury Department also announced additional sanctions against nearly a dozen for supporting Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, ballistic missile program, and cyber attacks against American businesses.
Whatever happens with respect to the future of the nuclear deal, the political signaling and commitment you see from this administration is to go after those destabilizing sources.
The Trump administration routinely faces a series of deadlines and decisions on whether to stay in the nuclear agreement. The next one, October 15th, and whether to certify that Iran is complying with the bulk of the deal. It's already done so twice. President Trump has called it the worst deal ever, though walking away would allow Iran to fully resume its nuclear program and blame the U.S. for scrapping the deal. With these new sanctions, the Trump administration says it will continue punishing Iran for its aggression outside its nuclear program, while staying in compliance with the nuclear agreement.
Missile tests, the activity of the Shia militias in Iraq, their work alongside Lebanese Hezbollah in Syria and in Lebanon, their malign activity all around the world has dramatically increased since this deal was struck.
Senior administration official says the president is still considering his options on U.S.-Iran policy. That includes whether to stay in the nuclear agreement. The official says the president will make his decision soon.
Sandy Rios back with you. Why does this matter? Amidst everything else we're hearing, about the new strikes of North Korea, the new tests, the greater the threats. We're hearing about so many things domestically, all the unrest. Why should we be concerned? Iran almost seems like a sleepy situation to us right now because it's more passive, and yet it is not. Fred Flights joins us this morning. He's the senior VP for the Center for Security Policy, and Iran is right in his bailiwick. Fred is formerly with the CIA, knows a great deal about what's going on in that part of the world. Fred, let me just ask you, why, a simple question, why should we be so concerned right now about this Iran deal when we've got North Korea to deal with?
We should be really concerned. And that first piece you played, I think, repeats a lot of the distortions about this story here. Iran can continue its nuclear weapons program and be fully in compliance with this agreement. Now, there's substantial evidence Iran is not in compliance. I regret Secretary Tillerson keeps saying Iran is technically compliant. That's not true. Ambassador Bolton has a fabulous plan to get us out of this deal and craft a new deal that actually reflects the security interests of our Middle East allies. You know, this Iran deal was negotiated with no input from Israel or the Gulf states. I think the president is going to do the right thing and back us out of this terrible agreement. But there's a lot of disinformation being circulated right now, and I think we have to counter that.
Fred, it's just such a double, triple, quadruple game. It's very difficult. You know, you're on the front lines of this, but I'd say for the average American, it's very hard to follow this. And so let me ask you some simple questions. Do we have any reason to believe that Iran is working, for instance, with North Korea and developing their nuclear weapons?
Yes, I think that's a very important question. We know through history that there's been very close collaboration in the development of ballistic missiles that are designed to carry nuclear weapons, that Iran has actually financed North Korea's missile program. We know that top Iranian nuclear scientists have been present at North Korean nuclear tests and missile tests. Now, it was a very interesting exchange on Fox special report last week with CIA Director Mike Pompeo. He was asked whether this collaboration on the nuclear question. He was strangely circumspect. Basically, he did more than we say that we can't write this off. He didn't dismiss it, but he seemed to say, well, that's something we really have to consider might be happening. I think there's every indication that Iran is not just financing North Korea's nuclear program, but it has outsourced nuclear weapons testing to North Korea so the international community will not be able to catch Iran doing this.
And I think, Fred, we need to explain again, because of the enormous amounts of news and detail people are having to absorb if they're trying to pay attention, we need to remember or remind people that the Iran deal involved America, under Barack Obama, sending boatloads of cash and gold and resources to Iran, which would make it possible for them to finance this stuff, correct?
Yeah, it was outrageous. We made hundreds of millions of dollars went to Iran in sanctions relief. And the day that the deal was announced, well, the day that the deal formally was implemented, it was announced in mid-2015, and early 2016, it was formally implemented. That meant Iran met certain conditions to get sanctions relief. The day that Barack Obama was bragging over that deal, he had approved aircraft secretly flying plane loads of cash to Tehran as ransom to release U.S. hostages. Now, the release of hostages was announced. We didn't find out about this cash, $400 million, until 7 months later when the Wall Street Journal reported it. Obama hid that from U.S. people, and he also hid that from Congress.
You know, I remember very well the big rally right in front of on the Capitol steps. I think Ted Cruz was leading. It was during the presidential election. He invited Donald Trump to come rally with him. And I think that Senator Cruz actually pulled President Trump into this fight and helped him to understand how dangerous this deal was. And President Trump then certainly took on the mantle of talking this about the worst deal in history, et cetera. But something has shifted, Fred. And you mentioned Rex Tillerson. Tell us, what's going on from your perspective around this president that would make it difficult at all for him to recertify or to not recertify and to pull us out of this deal? What are the other voices? Who's giving him opposite advice?
Well, under the law, the president has to certify every 90 days that Iran is complying and that the deal is in the national security interest of the United States. And he made the certification in March and July because his advisors are strongly for the deal, especially McMaster and Tillerson. And I think they simply have been captured by the mainstream foreign policy establishment, which just loves treaties. But the biggest thing is they don't want to offend the Europeans. That's not an argument that's working with President Trump. Trump indicated in July, this is it. I don't want to certify this again. I want other options. John Bolton wrote another option in response to the president's request. Steve Bannon passes on to Bolton. The president's advisors wouldn't let Bolton meet with Mr. Trump to present this plan. So Bolton published it in National Review. I understand the president is aware of the Bolton plan. I have to say it's sort of mind-boggling that everyone knows the president's position, and H.R. McMaster is trying to pursue another position. I mean, I'd ask, who made H.R. McMaster president?
Yeah, I'd ask that too. And I want to reemphasize what you just said, because I think it's one of the most dramatic, maybe undertold stories that's happened in the last few months, Fred, about Ambassador Bolton, who you know so well, and I know also, but you worked with him for so many years. And this is, he writes out this plan about how to deal with Iran. And this is an introduction, though, that he writes. Although candidate Donald Trump repeatedly criticized Barack Obama's Iran nuclear agreement, his administration has twice decided to remain in the deal. It's so certified to Congress, most recently in July, as required by law. Before the second certification, Trump asked repeatedly for alternatives to acquiescing yet again in a policy he clearly abhorred. But no such options were forthcoming, despite a sharp series of exchanges between the president and his advisors, as the New York Times and similar press reports characterized it. Many outside the administration wondered how this was possible. Was Trump in control, or were his advisors? Defining a compelling rationale to exist Obama's exit, Obama's failed nuclear deal, and elaborating a game plan to do so are quite easy. In fact, Steve Bannon asked me in late July to draw up just such a game plan for the president, the option he didn't have, which I did. Here it is. It's only 5 pages long, but like instant coffee, can be readily expanded to a comprehensive 100-page playbook if the administration were to decide to leave the Iran agreement. There's no need to wait for the certification deadline in October. Trump can and should free America from its execrable deal at the earliest opportunity. I offer the Iran non-paper now as a public service, since staff changes at the White House have made presenting it to President Trump impossible. Although he was once kind enough to tell me, come in and see me anytime, those days are now over. And Fred, I know you mentioned this, but let's land on this again. What happened? So John Bolton writes up this plan. He's asked by Steve Bannon, and then he can't present it?
Well, he was about to see the president, but Bannon was let go. So I'm not going to betray, confidential discussions. I'll simply say he called up and tried to get an appointment, and they wouldn't give him one.
Well, that says it, I guess. And so he published it in National Review. And by the way, we'll put this John Bolton's plan for Iran, because there is a plan. There can be a plan. There can be an alternative. We'll put that on our Facebook page. And also, Fred has just written an article talking about this upcoming, the president, I think it's in October, has to decide whether he's going to certify this deal or not. And so Fred has written an article discussing the arguments in favor and against. Fred, you seem still optimistic, though. Why the optimism?
Well, I'm optimistic the president is going to fulfill his campaign promises. Let me quickly talk about the worst argument to keep us in the deal. This is the sneaky one that just came out. The president can decertify the Congress, but will stay in the deal to fix it later. And I'm just wondering, what kind of magic spell do these people have that will hypnotize the Iranians to give up the baskets of goodies they got to go along with this terrible deal that Barack Obama gave them? It isn't going to happen. This is the idea that's being talked about constantly in the media. I don't think the president's going to go for that. If that is the position of the Iran deal backers, they're going down.
It's just amazing, and it just defies any kind of logic. I do think, Fred, in order to be graphic here, it doesn't take much imagination now to sort of think through the horrible things that North Korea could do if they have a nuclear weapon. If they're able to mount one on one of their missiles, we know now they can hit Guam, they could possibly hit Hawaii, some of the West Coast. So if Iran should finalize their ability to weaponize their nuclear capabilities, what would that mean? What would that look like?
I just think it's a horrible prospect, given that Iran, it's one of its primary policy objectives is the destruction of the state of Israel. Israel's extremely upset at Iran getting a nuclear weapon, and it would make Iran, it would change the power dynamics in the Middle East. And if Iran was to have these weapons, it would start testing them. When nations like this test, there's possibilities of accidents, there's possibilities of tests maybe in the atmosphere that will allow radiation to drift over other nations. It's really a horrible thought, and it's something that we can stop this by taking a much tougher stand against Iran and a much tougher stand against North Korea on their nuclear weapons program.
Susan Rice went before Congress last week, and she was being asked questions about why they unmask various Trump entities. And Fred, it all centered around the Iran deal. At least that's what she said in testimony. She said that they were afraid that Donald Trump was going to withdraw from the Iran deal. And so then she did what arguably were certainly unethical lapses in leaking information about Trump staffers. I would love to know what your thoughts about what that was all about.
Well, she's claiming that they were spying on the UAE ambassador who was meeting with Trump and not President Obama, supposedly because he wanted Trump to back out of the Iran deal. Now, wait a minute. I thought that the Obama White House told us that all the Middle East nations supported the Iran deal. Untrue, like most of the things it said. That was an interesting statement by Rice. It was unethical for her to be spying on the incoming administration on a policy. But beyond that, she was responsible for unmasking for a full year before that happened. That story isn't true either. As bad as it is, there's much more to this scandal.
Hey, Fred, have you got just a second more to stay with me, just for a few minutes?
Sure.
Okay, I don't want to put you in. All right, thanks. Let's do that, because I want to come back and play that report that Catherine Herridge did and flesh that out just a little bit more. And also, I just think more can be said about what's happening in the White House in regard to national security, because many of us are alarmed and concerned. And I want let's just talk about a little bit further. Fred Feitz is my guest. He's the Vice President for the Center for Security Policy. And we'll be back right after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Corner. Mika Brzezinski, in a rare moment of candor, revealed what many Americans have long suspected. On air, she disclosed that it was the media's job to control exactly what people think. In discussing President Trump, she went on to say he could undermine the messaging so much that he could actually control exactly what people think. And that's our job. Messaging is a phrase used by PR firms. It's not the verbiage of journalists. Brzezinski's comments acutely frame the reality that the modern national media is driven to control, not inform.
Visit the Hamilton Corner on the podcast page at AFR.net. For more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
We're collecting stories of how God is using American Family Radio in the lives of our listening family. These small stories serve as big encouragement to those who partner with us financially and to those who are considering partnering with us. Would you take a moment to call right now and tell us your story of how we've impacted your life? Phone 877-876-8893. That's 877-876-8893.
Do people in heaven know what's happening down below? Will heaven be the same for everyone? And when we get there, will we still remember those we knew on earth? This week on Pathway to Victory, Dr. Robert Jeffress answers these commonly asked questions. It's a brand new series, A Place Called Heaven. Join us this Monday through Friday for Pathway to Victory.
Pathway to Victory, each weekday morning at 6 o'clock Central on American Family Radio.
I feel so hopeless.
Is there any hope? I just feel like there's no hope at all.
Is there any hope?
Get hope.
Last year, I visited a startup company.
That's TWR President Lauren Libby.
It was in Silicon Valley, the hotbed of new ideas. What an intriguing culture. A culture in which 6 months is an eternity. A culture in which people were sleeping under desks and eating cold pizza for breakfast. Why would people get involved in this frenzied culture? Why? Hope. Hope is what the future will bring. Success, a future, financial rewards, and notoriety. Most notable accomplishments have come from people who see a future and, because of hope, give their lives to making that future happen. Jesus brought hope, not short-term, startup hope, but hope that lasts forever.
Need more hope? We have resources waiting for you, including a free devotional. You'll find them at GetHopeRadio.com. That's GetHopeRadio.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, Congress, with President Trump's approval, embraced a post-Charlottesville narrative about hate groups that explicitly condemns white supremacists and neo-Nazis, but makes no mention of other enemies of freedom currently much in evidence here, like Antifa, communists, anarchists, and black and Sharia supremacists. By so doing, this joint resolution has encouraged the latter's efforts to denounce, suppress, and ultimately criminalize the free speech of anyone deemed a hater or bigot. The question then becomes, who does the deeming? It's worrying that Rod Rosenstein, the Justice Department's number two official, seems to have at least implicitly endorsed this week two discredited yet self-appointed arbiters of hate and therefore of speech in America. Our leaders should explicitly repudiate, not legitimize by attending conferences featuring, the radical leftist Southern Poverty Law Center and its ally, CARE, the Hamas-founded Council on American-Islamic Relations. This is Frank Affney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Former National Security Advisor Susan Rice told the House Intelligence Committee that she unmasked Trump transition officials in December 2016 because she was bothered by a Trump Tower meeting with the United Arab Emirates Crown Prince. A source close to the UAE delegation said they wanted the incoming Trump administration to dial back the Iran deal and blunt Tehran's influence in the Gulf. The source also questioned whether Rice was more concerned about protecting the Iran deal and President Obama's foreign policy legacy than Russia's election meddling. Middle East analysts say the Crown Prince's strained relationship with the Obama White House was well known.
Iran was priority one, two, and three. They basically wanted a much more aggressive U.S. posture against, first and foremost, Iranian regional aggression that posed a direct threat to them and the other Gulf states.
The December 2016 meeting reportedly included the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, former campaign strategist Steve Bannon, incoming National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and the Crown Prince. Rice said the Gulf delegation had asked for a meeting with President Obama, then canceled, saying they weren't coming to the U.S., then came quietly to see the Trump team. Hannah believes Iran was top of the agenda, but emphasized the Crown Prince, along with other Gulf leaders, had drawn closer to the Russian president.
It's largely, I think, a hedging move for fear that the United States could be abandoning them, that they needed some kind of relationship with Russia.
All right, that's the first part of Catherine Herridge's report on Fox last night, but let's listen to the rest of it just a minute.
A Capitol Hill source said Rice's closed classified testimony confirmed that she used intelligence community tools to identify or unmask Trump transition team members because she was suspicious of their activities 1 month before the inauguration. That was a core allegation leveled by the committee's Republican chairman that was roundly criticized by Democrats last spring.
What I've read seems to me to be some level of surveillance activity, perhaps legal. But I don't know that it's right, and I don't know that the American people would be comfortable with what I've read. But let us get all the reports.
Fox News asked Rice and her team whether Iran or Russia drove her decision to unmask Trump transition officials. Spokeswoman did not directly address our question, citing classified information, but said in a statement to Fox, quote, there is nothing improper, unusual, or political about such requests, nor do such requests bear any relationship to the unfounded and debunked allegations that the Obama White House ordered the surveillance of any U.S. persons.
Sandy Rios back with you. That was Catherine Herridge. There's no question that for whatever reason, the Barack Obama administration, with the help of Valerie Jarrett and Susan Rice and all the other players, were committed to helping Iran in every way possible. And that, to me, is a mystery. And Fred Flights is my guest. He's the senior VP for the Center for Security Policy. Fred, we know that Valerie Jarrett grew up in Iran. We know that the president of the United States, as in Barack Obama, was certainly sympathetic to the Muslim world. He has made his first international speech after becoming president to the Muslim world. He had a fixation, and he was determined. He even dedicated the space program to improving to acknowledging the role of Muslims in space. It was just it's amazing the things that the president Barack Obama did to enhance just our understanding of Islam. But why Iran? Why this fascination with Iran? And why all of these millions of dollars to Iran in the dark of night? Why this deal that is so obviously threatening to America's safety? Why do you think the president was so devoted, and Valerie Jarrett and Susan Rice, to helping Iran?
Well, I mean, Barack Obama was far more radical a president than most Americans recognize. I think it comes up from how he cut his political teeth in Chicago with a variety of far-left radicals. He's someone who came to office thinking that basically the origin of instability and terrorism in the world was the United States. That's why we saw these apology tour speeches. That's why when Barack Obama went to the UN General Assembly every year, he would apologize to Iran. He would talk about how, you know, we have a lot to account for in our past experience with Iran, and maybe we can therefore explain Iran's hostility. No, this is just absolute nonsense. But I mean, this permeated everything that Barack Obama did. That America is not a good force in the world in the international community. And I mean, this kind of nonsense. I think the terrorists and people who hate us, they just ate it up. They're basically, Obama's agreeing with him. America is a force for good and stability in the world. A strong and decisive America is how the world is safer and more stable. And that's why things went to hell in the Middle East and the Asia-Pacific. In the Middle East, we were leading from behind. In the Asia-Pacific, we weren't leading at all. We were absent. And the North Koreans took advantage of this. And that's why we're in a very serious situation today with their nuclear program.
Boy, that's the truth. And, okay, so Fred, Because I do what I do, because I'm from Chicago, I do know the answers to the questions I just asked you about the fascination with Iran, unfortunately. But the thing that is still flummoxing to me is why Rex Tillerson, you know, former CEO of this major oil company, why H.R. McMaster, a former questionable success as a military leader, certainly bombastic, written a book. You know, you'd think that maybe it would be a given that they would love their country and that they would not be in favor of a deal that puts us at risk. What is causing this drive to get this current president to sign off on this terrible deal?
Well, I think the president listened to a lot of people when he put his cabinet together, and I believe he relied a little too heavily on people like Condoleezza Rice and Henry Kissinger, and people who pushed the president in the direction of individuals who were very close to the foreign policy establishment. I think that the president should have chosen people like John Bolton for senior positions rather than McMaster and Tillerson, who I don't think represent the president's views. Look, on paper, they're very good, and they've been good on some issues, but I think that the president laid out a certain agenda, and in trying to find the best people, look, Condoleezza Rice is very clever, very smart, but when she was in the Bush administration, she was a terrible national security advisor. She was a terrible secretary of state. The Iranian-North Korean nuclear programs made major gains when she was secretary of state because she pursued a policy of appeasement, too, which I'm writing about, in a forthcoming book. I'm hoping that the president will make some adjustments by the end of the year. He will give some of these people the boot. He's evaluated them, and he will basically move his foreign policy agenda closer to what he promised during the campaign.
Boy, don't we all. And let me just remind you, if you just tuned in, Fred has written an article in National Review called The Iran Deal's Backers Are Getting Desperate, and we're going to put that on our Facebook page, and we're also going to include John Bolton's plan. It's not a long plan. It's how to get out of the Iran nuclear deal. And the reason you can read this is because the people we just mentioned blocked President Trump from ever getting to see John Bolton's plan for how to getting out of the Iran deal. So Ambassador Bolton published it on National Review. We're going to put it on our Facebook page. In short, Fred, before I let you go, what are the high points that Ambassador Bolton is suggesting? What are the main points? How could we get out of this deal?
Well, look, this Iran deal is not a treaty. It may not even be an executive agreement. It wasn't ratified by the Senate. All Mr. Trump has to say is, we're out. And Bolton would like another approach. We start with very tough sanctions, barring any company worldwide from transferring nuclear technology to Iran. And any company that does that can't do business with the United States, and we will go after them. We will go after their nation. I think that's the priority. Bolton wants to have a new international alliance against Iran that includes Israel, that includes the Gulf states. How could we come up with a treaty or an agreement on Iran that excluded Israel? I mean, Iran's a bigger threat to Israel than it is to us. That problem is going to be addressed immediately in this new strategy.
You know, before I let you go, Fred, I just have to ask you this. And my understanding last week, within the last week or 7 days, there was a meeting with, a meeting from some Israeli officials, an inside meeting, and Trump administration invited someone into that meeting that was an apologist for Hamas, and the leaders of the Israeli leaders demanded that he leave the room. Now, there are conflicting reports about that. Some say, yes, that happened, and others say, no, that didn't happen. What do you know about that?
I don't know what happened. I think something happened that shouldn't have happened. I don't know whether the initial story was incorrect. Frankly, I'm seeing back and forth right now. What I will say is that the president came out with a very strong position against radical Islam, and under McMaster and other officials in the NSC, that term has disappeared. And I think getting rid of McMaster and putting back the approach the president promised when he ran for president is essential. And I think whatever happened to this meeting reflects this effort by McMaster to move Trump policy in some other direction.
Yes, and so that's why we, let me just say, Center for Security Policy is on the front lines of trying to stop the nonsense that's going on now in the White House. And there are many people who are just crying out right now because we could stop things. We could draw out of this Iran deal. We could do something about North Korea. But we have to have different people giving the president advice. So that's just an issue of prayer and concern. And for Fred and others at the Center for Security Policy, it's a matter of action for them. And so we need to pray for them, and we will do that. Fred, listen, thank you for your expertise, for your service to this country, and for your friendship. Senior Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, thank you so much, Fred.
Great to be here, Sandy. Thank you.
All right, my pleasure. You know, with that in mind, Sebastian Gorka did an interview with Breitbart just in the last few days. And Sebastian, who was a national security expert on the Trump team who was released, about 2 weeks ago, had this to say. Let's listen.
When I came on board to work for Steve Bannon as a strategist to the president, I wanted to bring over some of my former students to work with us in the White House who were already in government, who had graduated years ago and were members of the intelligence community. And I identified the three best individuals and requested, as a deputy assistant to the president, that these people be detailed over to me at the White House to work on key projects of import to Steve and the president. In the 6 months I was in office, not one of those people was detailed over to me from an unnamed sister agency. And I found out, not only did the sister agency stop their detailing, every single individual was taken off their current duty roster and punished and put into menial tasks outside of the real national security remit through no fault of their own. Why? Because the seventh floor of that agency, to quote a senior individual, looks at the White House as the enemy.
So there you go. And that's just a realistic report this morning from me to you about what's going on in the White House. It is just a battle. And well, let me just say that conservatives are not faring well right now, but the battle isn't over. And so this is how you can wisely pray. So I just mentioned it to you. So you'll do that. You'll join me in doing that. A couple of other things. You know, there was a terror attack in London in the last few days. I think it happened Thursday, Friday night. 22 people injured. We now have some more information about this 18-year-old guy who seems to be at the center of it, but maybe not acting alone. But I want to tell you, and of course we'll be hearing more and more about that as they reveal their investigation. It amazes me how they keep talking about how was he radicalized. And it's just the mystifying repetition of the ignorance is amazing to me when we actually can know what motivates these terror attacks. And that reminds me of another attack that happened in France. It's four American students who were the victims of an acid attack. They're Boston College juniors in their 20s, all of them really pretty girls. There's an article in the Daily Mail that shows each of their pictures. Courtney, Charlotte, Michelle, and Kelsey, those are their names, but they sound quintessentially American. The attacker was 41 years old. They say it was not an act of terror. I don't really know how they conclude that because I don't trust their analysis, but it might not have been. I don't know. But the point I want to tell you is that Courtney Silverling was one of the girls attacked, and I want you to hear what she has to say. She was two of them were hit in the face, and other received, one of them had a loss of eyesight. I don't know if it's permanent, but let me just show you what Courtney wrote on her Facebook. Thank you so much, everyone who has reached out to see if I'm okay and has been praying for us. I didn't receive injuries from the attack, any injuries. The French police have been great. I pray that the attacker would be healed from her mental illness in the name of Jesus, and receive the forgiveness and salvation that can only come from Him. This I declare about the Lord. He alone is my refuge, my place of safety. He is my God, and I trust Him. What a brave kid, and what a lover of Jesus, and how God shines His light in the midst of all the confusion and the danger that we face. And so He will do and shall do in each and every one of these situations in ways we may never know. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.